around 1939 or 40, Eilenberg, who knew, according to Miles told me yesterday, that Hopf was the first person to observe this, that the cohomology of a k pi 1 space depended only on the group pi. A k pi 1 space is a space that has one homotopy group pi, the fundamental group is pi, and all the other homotopy groups are trivial. And I guess it's also connected, so pi 0 is 1. That the homology of such a space depended only on the group pi, that it didn't depend on which particular example of k pi 1 you took. And Eilenberg was attempting to compute the homology and I guess the cohomology purely in terms of pi, and this led him to certain computations. In the meantime, McQuain was attempting to compute, or was computing, what I guess you could call the Bayer group of pi. Let me just give it a name temporarily. With coefficients in a pi module A, and what this is what we would say today is a set of all exact sequences like so. There's a way of adding two such sequences, classes, well, equivalence classes of exact sequence. Yes, equivalence classes under a particular equivalence relation of the existence of a homomorphism that makes this both of these squares commute. Such a homomorphism is necessarily an isomorphism, but not every isomorphism between pi and pi prime could be modified to make those squares commute. So it's a finer equivalence relation than just isomorphism. Anyway, Eilenberg was at the University of Michigan, and McQuain was invited to give a talk there, and he did give a talk there talking about these things, and Eilenberg realized that they were doing the same computations. And as a result, they got together, and already by, I forget whether it was 1941 or 1942, they had published a paper which is identifiably the beginnings of group cohomology. However, they published two papers in which they did the group cohomology in a way which could still be done today. I think they were in 45 and 46. I've forgotten. Anyway, the paper will have all the references in it. And of course, the two of them did many more things together, including, in particular, homology of other k pi n spaces. I guess that was probably their best known work. They defined. They defined the cohomology of a group as follows. So we start again with a group pi, a pi module A, and you look at arbitrary functions from pi, the nth Cartesian power of pi to A, but just functions. So this, with the addition just pointwise in A, this gives an abelian group, which is the group of cochains Cn pi A. There's a co-boundary operator, which given an N cochain produces an N plus 1 cochain, according to a formula, delta F acting on n plus 1 elements, you use F. Sorry, this one does have a coefficient. A particular case is when pi acts trivially on A, which means that every element of pi x is the identity automorphism, and so in that case this term can be suppressed, but anyway. Where does it start? And finally, I want the first term to start with 1, and I want it to involve x0. Well, that's correct. But I think this is right. I want the first term to be x0 times x1, and I want it to have a sign minus 1. And so the sum goes from 0 to n minus 1, from 1 to n minus 1, and then we finally have this term. For later use, let me just put an xn here, but to make the right action be by the identity so that xn doesn't affect anything. Okay. It's not hard to show that the compositive 2 of these is 0, and so we can define, as usual, hn pi a to be the kernel of delta from cn to cn plus 1 mod the image of delta from cn minus 1 to cn, and this is the nth cohomology. And that was their definition. And let me just take a minute and show how the H2 of pi A actually, I won't show the whole thing, but anyway, to indicate how you get from an extension of this sort to an element of H2 of pi A. So, starting with an extension of this sort, let me call this P. Let me assume that that's an inclusion, although I'll still write the elements of A additively and the elements of, you'll see. Begin by choosing a section. Just a function, not a homomorphism. Of course, in some case it might be possible to have a homomorphism, but that will give the zero class. But in general, just choose a function such that Ps is 1. And then it's not hard to show that pi as a set, capital Pi as a set, can be viewed as consisting of pairs of elements from A and Pi, a typical element being A S of X. Now, the next thing we do is we define F by the equation 0 S of X times 0 S of Y equals. Now, the point is that when I multiply two elements of this sort, their first coordinate has to be S of X, Y, because the projection is xy. It differs from S of X, S of Y by some element of A, and that's what F of xy is. That defines F, and it's not hard to show, in fact, it's essentially triviality, that the associativity of the multiplication here is equivalent to the fact that delta F is zero. We say that F is a co-cycle. Moreover, it's also not hard to show that the equivalence relation is equivalent to, if I take two of those extensions, they're equivalent if and only if the corresponding two co-cycles differ by a two co-boundary. And so there's simply a one-to-one correspondence between equivalence classes of extensions like this and elements of each two. Well, of course they did that, but let's not complicate things. Normalization, you can stick to F for which F of is zero when any of the arguments is equal to one. That basically comes from the fact that you could let S of the identity element be the identity element, but I'm not getting into that level of detail. They also could give simple interpretations of H0 and H1. H0 was simply this, the so-called, the fixed set of pi, the fixed set of A under the action of pi. And H1 was what were called derivations or sometimes called cross homomorphisms. I'll explain that. Mod inner derivations. And what were derivations? A derivation from pi to A is simply it was originally called a cross homomorphism. And then later on, after associative algebra cohomology came along, we tended to call them derivations, but you'll see that in a second. Anyway, a derivation was something like this. An inner derivation was a derivation of the form dx equals xa minus a for some a in a. And in other words, so that was an inner derivation. And the quotient derivations, not inner derivations, that was H1. There was also a connection between H3 and non-abelian extensions. In other words, where you simply had some group, say G, as a kernel, and pi as a quotient, it turns out that under these circumstances, first place you get a function from pi into aught of G that sends, say G is going to be a normal subgroup here, so you get a function from G into aught of G, namely takes an element of pi to the inner automorphism, not inner automorphism, but to the conjugation by that element. Here we have the inner automorphisms of G, which when G is normal in pi, it turns out that this is a normal subgroup of this. And from that we get a quotient, which I'll call the outer automorphisms of G. And this gives a map from pi to the outer automorphisms of G. You see, in the abelian case, if G happened to be an abelian group, this group is trivial, and we get directly a map from pi to the automorphisms of G. That just says that G is a pi module. In this case, G is not a pi module, but we get such a row. Well, it turns out that given such a row, there is canonically an element corresponds to some element of H3 of pi with coefficients in the center of G. which of course is a pi module, because the inner automorphisms of G act trivially on the center of G. But that turns out to be zero. On the other hand, given an element, given an a homomorphism here, and you ask, well, does it come from a picture like this? The answer is it comes from a picture like this, if and only if this element, the corresponding element here, is zero. And also, it connects the set of them, the set of the equivalence classes of such extensions, assuming that this is zero, then the 1-1 correspondence between this set and this cohomology. In fact, the set of automorphisms is a principal homogeneous object over this, is what it amounts to. There's an action, natural action. It's not an abelian group, but it is a natural action of this on the set, and it's a principal homogeneous action. Then Hochschild, pretty much at the same time, did the same thing, almost exactly the same thing for associative algebras. By the way, although it may not, probably not that important, but every element of H3 turns out to be the obstruction, so-called, to one of these things. Now, Hochschild came along and did much the same thing for associative algebras. You know, if this had been a computer science institute, they'd have had electric blackboards. They're cheaper. Well, the middle one doesn't work very well, but anyway. Okay. Anyway, Hochschild began with a... First place, he did it over a field. It can be done over a commutative ring instead, but in that case, you just get a relative cohomology theory relative to things which are split over the over K. Anyway, I don't have to specify. Takes a K-algebra lambda, define a cohomology class to be a map from lambda to the nth tensor power into some lambda module A. You go through same equations. I mean, after all, a map from the nth tensor power can just be thought of as an n-linear map from the nth Cartesian power. So that's another way of describing it, and I think that's how Hochschild actually did describe it. And the theorems that were involved were essentially the same theorems. You have extensions like this, and you have, instead of abelian kernel, you have kernels with square zero. And here, instead of non-abelian kernels, you just have arbitrary ideal. But other than that, the kinds of theorems you prove about it are exactly the same. And so that was Hochschild. Chevalier and Eilenberg did something similar, well, yeah, quite similar for Lie algebras. The formulas were different. Instead of just n-linear maps, here they used alternating n-linear maps. Now, it's pretty obvious that if you used such a co-boundary formula, then the co-boundary of an alternating map wouldn't alternate, because it treats the first, among other things, it treats the first and last coordinate different. But anyway, the co-boundary formula they had was entirely different, and they didn't get it just by guessing or something. They got it by translating from cohomology theory of manifolds. Somewhere in one of the papers, it says that explicitly. So it's a little bit more complicated, but anyway, it works. But anyway, they proved the same sorts of theorems with extensions and derivations and inner derivations and so on, and also extensions. Again, the H2 was by extensions of square zero, which are also called abelian extensions in the case of Lie algebras, and the H3 was obstructions to other kinds of extensions. And I think up until 1960 or so, they were the only, at least as far as I'm aware, the only cohomology theories that had been defined. That came, do you know that he started this before 19, I mean, he certainly didn't publish it till 62.
Yeah, it was there.
Yeah, I know it wasn't published. I know when it was published. Oh. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, I forgot about amateur cohomology. I hadn't forgotten about Harrison. Yes. Anyway, in 1956, Cartan and Eilenberg published their book, and basically their book set out a thesis that said this is what a cohomology theory in algebra is. And they had found a uniform description that covered the three cohomology theories that I've mentioned. And their description was very simple. In each of these categories, you had objects. Let me call an object X, not to specify what it is. Group, an associative algebra, a Lie algebra, whatever. You had a notion of X module, which in the case of groups is just some left action. In the case of associative algebras is a two-sided module. And in the case of Lie algebras was a Lie algebra module, which is something which is has a left action from the Lie algebra, and it satisfies a Jacobi-like identity for the associativity, instead of associativity. In each case, there was an enveloping, so-called enveloping algebra, with the property that left X to the E modules were, that the category of left X to the E modules is exactly the same as the category of X modules, whatever that was. And there was a particular X module, let me call it XJ. There's no standard name for it, such that the cohomology could be described as that X. And they went through in some detail and showed how this worked for groups, how this worked for associative algebras, how it worked for Lie algebras. Lie algebras is actually a little bit complicated, partly because XE was the enveloping algebra of the Lie algebra, and Poincaré-Witt theorem had to be invoked, and there were some complications. But anyway, it all worked. And as far as they were concerned, or apparently as far as they were concerned, this was what an algebraic cohomology theory was supposed to be. However, notice one thing. Well, first place, there's several ad hocaries involved here. First, what is an X module? Second, and wait a minute, what's the third? Oh, well, what is XE? That should have been second, but anyway. Well, the first of these questions, which in many ways should have been the most mysterious, was one of the first answered, and it was answered in a rather surprising way by John Beck. No, this is the one that doesn't stay up. who observed that an X module is an abelian group object of the category, well, I didn't name the category, but let me call it X, over the object X. They're really, I think, quite a surprising fact and quite an ingenious discovery. And I don't really know where it came from. I guess he just looked at examples. But you see, when you, well, I still have the abelian groups up there. When you look up there, you'll see that for any, consider this sequence that I have there. For any other group G, a map from G to capital Pi makes G into a group over little pi just by composite, and the set of maps is that fix this is basically determined by maps from G to A, and that's an abelian group. Certain maps from G to A, and that forms an abelian group. You can make similar arguments for associative algebras, for Lie algebras, whatever. You can turn it around. These are the abelian group objects in the category of groups over little pi, namely these sequences. And equivalent sequences are isomorphic group are isomorphic as group objects. Script X is some category, any category. Yeah. So in other words, now we know if I take a category X and if I take an object, if I take category script X, I take an object X. What is an X module? It is an abelian group object over X. A perfectly general answer. Of course, it's not the case that in every category it's a useful answer, but anyway, in the categories we're interested in, it is. Because in the categories that we're interested in, it turns out that the category of X modules is the category of modules over a ring. And that ring we call XE. Now, of course, XE is defined only up to Morita equivalence, but that's okay because X is Morita invariant, so that isn't going to change anything anyway. It seems that in cases that we know, there's a natural choice for XE, but that's unimportant because a Morita equivalent ring would do just as well. Other than that, everything is uniquely determined by X. Now, of course, it's obviously not the case that you'll always get a category of modules over a ring, but I think if script X is a finitary equational theory, it is the case. Although, it is, yeah. I'm pretty sure, too. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, Peter assures me, I certainly was entirely convinced without really having checked it, that if you take a finitary equational theory and you take an object in it, then the category of modules over that object is going to be the category of abelian groups over that object, or the category of X modules, is going to be the category of modules for some ring. Because it's going to be an abelian category, and it's going to be finitary, and yeah. So it seems clear, and Peter says it's true. I mean, anyway, I can see the argument, and I don't see any problem with it. That only leaves this question: what is XJ? And let me briefly, I really can't answer that question, but let me briefly say something about it. In every case that I've been looking at, in every one of those three cases, H0 before I say that, let me just point out that since Tom since this is an abelian group, well, we can give it a name, and in every one of the cases it's simply the group of derivations. In other words, you take an object over X. This is an abelian group because A is, by definition, an abelian group object. Now, this notation is a little bit abusive because here I'm using A as an ordinary module. Here I'm using A as this abelian group object in the category over. But let me do that. And in every one of the cases, this can be identified very easily as the group of derivations. So, in fact, we've partially, the trivial map from
A to be an object over X.
I want A to be an object over X. Now, the object over X is something like this. It's going to be the split extension of X by A, literally. Yeah. So, okay, if you like, sometimes I use this notation. A bow tie X over X. I mean, it's a twisted product, semi-direct product, yeah. Okay, so maybe that's, okay, that's better notation, something like that.
And then you just forget that to go down to the next one.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm saying that in the specific cases of groups, associative algebras, Lie algebras, this actually is true, and after that we take it as a definition. Just like we always do. Find three cases where it's true, and after that it's a definition. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so where was I? I was trying to explain XJ. Now, H1 is always derivations mod inner derivations. And so inner derivations, let me see how this works. I've written it down. Maybe I better just get what I've written down since I never remember precisely how to state this. Oh, right. Derivations is a Hom functor, you see it here. And under reasonable hypotheses, you know, and this, of course, is taking place in well, it's in a mixed category, but anyway, it looks like a Hom functor. Let's assume that it's representable. And so this is Hom in the category of XE modules of something. This is a hypothesis as it stands, which again is probably satisfied under very reasonable assumptions that this group of derivations is going to be represented by some ordinary XE module. You see. Now, what happens is that the inner derivations, how does this work? The inner derivations are somehow okay, let me not worry about this. Anyway, the real point is that if I take X itself, not this object here, this is a subobject of the ring XE. This actually comes out of the inner derivations, but I've forgotten exactly how. Anyway, and XJ is the quotient. You see, in the three cases that I started with, XJ has a very different nature. In the case of groups, XJ is just the group of integers with trivial action from the group. In the case of associative algebras, XE is the lambda tensor lambda opposite, and XJ is lambda itself. And in the case of Lie algebras, XJ is the ground field, K. And but anyway, in all three cases, this turns out to be an exact sequence. Now, diff is actually much more natural than XJ. Moreover, if you try to think of the cohomology as a functor in the first variable instead of the second, and there are good reasons for doing that, which I should mention, It turns out that a much better way to view the cohomology is as XE diff X and A. Now this differs from the old one only in one only by a shift of one dimension because of this exact sequence. But for example, it gives a cohomology theory in which the cohomology of a free ring is trivial. Under the original definition, the cohomology of a free group, the cohomology of a free algebra, the cohomology of a free Lie algebra, these were only zeros starting from degree 2 on, but not in degree 1. If we change this, the cohomology is 0 starting from degree 1. But there's a better reason for doing this. And that is, under either definition, using diff or xj here, the cohomology is going to be 0 as soon as A is an injective module. That's because of the nature of x. But when commutative cohomology came along, that failed. In fact, for any ring, for any field, if I take this extension, this kernel, which is actually isomorphic to this, except by multiplying x by x squared. Yes, that's x to the fourth. This kernel is isomorphic to the free algebra 1 generator, but this is a self-injective ring. This kernel is injective. This has square 0. This sequence does not split. This proves that you cannot really hope to hope to force the Harrison cohomology theory into the Cartan-Eilenberg mold, and something else is necessary. Well, the something else soon came along. I'm running out of time, of course, we always do. But that was the co-triple cohomology. This was first explored in depth in John Beck's thesis. In fact, it was in connection with this that he discovered his definition of modules. And this was basically, you begin with your category X. Let's assume now that X is models of an equational theory, so that there's a free algebra co-triple on X. For any X, there is the co-triple resolution. Etc. Given any module A, we form using the alternating sum of the maps induced by the face operators. The degeneracies can be ignored for this purpose. Form the cohomology. In this case, if you do this, you get something like the dimension-shifted cohomology. H0 is derivations, that's obvious. H1 is going to be these extensions. H2 is going to be obstructions, as before. And the higher cohomology groups are whatever they are. Now, in the three cases of groups, associative algebras, Lie algebras, it has been shown that this definition of cohomology gives exactly the same cohomology groups as the old original definitions. As far as the Harrison cohomology is concerned, it does, but only in characteristic zero. And in finite characteristic, this definition is now, well, it certainly was the one used by Michel Andre in his book on the subject of commutative cohomology, and seems to be, quote, the correct definition, unquote. However, there are examples in finite characteristic to show that Harrison's original definition does not give the same answer. Now, in proving this, well, John Beck and I attempted during the spring of 64 to prove this, and we spent some time looking at it before Eilenberg came around and told me to disappear because he wanted John Beck to finish his thesis. Didn't work, although he eventually did 3 years later, but Sammy was right about that. But anyway, we spent the entire fall of 64 at Urbana trying to do this and got absolutely nowhere, absolutely zero. We couldn't make a dent in the problem. John went to New York over Christmas vacation 64, spoke to Harry Applegate, who uttered the magic words, acyclic models. John came back, told me about it, and within a week or two, we had settled at least the associative algebras and group case. It was amazing, just amazing. For some reason, nobody ever looked at the Lie algebra case until about 1995 when I finally sat down and settled it. It was a little bit harder, but it wasn't that much harder. And about 2 months before my paper appeared, the same editor of the same journal got a paper from somebody else doing the same thing. But mine was had already been accepted for publication. So this poor Zlev lost that completely. Anyway, that's a very quick survey of the early days of cohomology theory. Thank you.